Well, sometimes they have to kill us. They have to kill us. Because they can't break our spirit.
Look, I don't have to do this.
You don't have any choice.
I'm trying to help you people. Now, why won't you accept that?
It's in our DNA. You have to do what old man says.
What makes you such a threat?
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power, Ray.
Prophecy Keepers Radio.
This is Joss Ogonie, Will Bluewater, a seventh grade grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. OCO, Ginalii, this is Blue Otter coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the Cherokee Nation. Atomic inner space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of Terra Firma assayers. Their 20-year mission, to explore the space between atoms, to seek out rare resources and lost civilizations, to boldly find what no man has found before. We'll be right back.
Well, hello, everybody. This is your old buddy Blue Otter coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee. And I've wanted to interview my old friend Robert for a long time. This guy had a tremendous influence on me since, I guess, the late 80s. I can't remember if it was the mid-80s or the late 80s, about 1990, but Robert has Indian ancestry like I do, and he was a Native activist for many years, still is. But I guess at some point he came to the conclusion that, you know, nothing's going to change in Indian country unless there's commerce. And I kind of lost track of him for about 10 years. I had no idea that when we were doing Indian stuff that he had any interest in the metallurgy. But when I reconnected with him, I found out that in the 10 years that we were out of touch, that he had built something called a magnetic resonance, a nuclear resonance magnetometer. And I have spent a lot of time sitting with him, hours and hours and hours, you know, sitting with him, and he actually taught me a little bit of how this works. But Robert operates a website called terrafirmaassayers.com, and I have personally seen letters from some of the most foremost computer assay outfits in the country and a lot of other people to know that he is highly respected. And I guess I'll just let it go at that, and we'll let Robert answer some questions. Basically, why don't you tell the folks, what is a resonator? What do they sell for, and what about their reputation in the scientific world?
Engineering to Captain Kirk.
Kirk, yeah, what is this, Scotty?
Ready to try it when you are, sir.
Well, Scott, a resonator has been around for at least 50 years, and they sell anywhere from $400 or $500 to $50,000, and they can go up pretty high. They put a lot of bells and whistles on them, but the truth is, Scott, in the scientific world, nobody has ever documented and proved that they actually work. You know, you can call it electronic dowsing. There's a lot of terms for it. I figured it was something that I could probably make work, but I knew when I started it was almost impossible because people in the field didn't really understand. They would hear a really good story, a lot of promo, a lot of advertisements. They would buy a resonator. They would test it in the office on a piece of gold or a piece of silver, and it would work there. Then they would take it out in the field, and they would dig a hole, and there wouldn't be anything there. And this has been going on since time immemorial. When I took it on, I tried to isolate what was working, when it worked, and why it worked. And if I had known, Scott, it was going to be that much work and that much difficulty, I probably wouldn't have taken it on, because it took me quite a few years to find out why it worked today and not tomorrow. And there's a lot of reasons why that's going on. For one, when you resonate a piece of gold and you know the frequency of gold, what people don't know and what they have not known is that the atomic spacing is what determines the actual frequency of that gold. And there's cosmic anomalies that go on that change the atomic spacing. One of them is the moon. Sometimes the moon is full and in between, and sometimes it's in apogee, sometimes it's in perigee. And the gravity pressure from the Earth actually changes the atomic spacing in the elements, so they're all in flux. So if you resonate gold today, will not do it tomorrow or the next day. And if you're off one or two tenths of a hertz, you bleed into another element, and that's what you're stimulating. That was the biggest problem I had. I was able to correct that. And, you know, when I go out in the field today, I will test whatever element I'm looking for, see what it's resonating at that day, you know, that hour. And so that makes my system better, and that's only part of it. Entrainment, I'll give you an example of entrainment. Take a gold coin, and put it on a big piece of iron. When I did these tests, I put it on the negative terminal of my battery because I knew that was grounded through the entire vehicle. I got back and resonated it, and you know the entire vehicle red is gold because the energy from the gold entrained the truck.
Uh-huh.
And the whole truck, and I'd worked on that for years to be able to block entrainment, and I finally succeeded at that. So now I can put a gold coin on the truck, and the only thing I'm on is one gold coin.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so that's behind.
But people don't understand everything has a field. We have a field, and some people call it an aura, but everything has a field and around it, and the fields...
Everything does, Scott. I call that the ionic aura or the ionic wind. When I stimulate an element, it vibrates the atoms. And basically, if you're going to stimulate an element, like say you got a bar of silver in the ground, everything has an aura. And the ions that come, ion particles that come from an element, that's basically what I'm stimulating. In order to stimulate the gold itself or the silver, you'd have to have a lot of wattage and an enormous amount of power. You don't really need to. Basically, what you're doing is you're stimulating the ions in the material. Those ions, with a camera, with the right filters, are actually visible. David Nuezella developed a camera where you could actually see those. You put the lens on it. He didn't develop the camera. He developed the lens that you put on a camera and take a picture of an area where there is metal underneath the ground, and you'll actually see part of that in the image. But I didn't go with that because the problem with that was it worked, but it couldn't tell the difference between solid gold and gold ore. And when you're out there in the field, there's a lot of stuff on the ground, so I couldn't really go with that.
Oh, yeah, you know, that we've got some really popular TV shows nowadays, you know, Gold Rush and other shows, and people can really get an idea of just how difficult it is to obtain this stuff because it's, I mean, they're up in Alaska and Canada, they're going after, you know, the stuff that's about as fine as flour and
right.
Very costly to go after. And so I think people are beginning to get an appreciation for why they have a cell phone because, you know, without gold, you know, you're not going to have a lot of computer technology and oh, did you hear today
right.
the Bundesbank Deutschland has called in its gold bullion?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That happened just today, and with the price of gold, I guess when I got back to Utah. In 2006, what was the price of gold then? Had it yet gone up over 1,000? I guess it was about 1,200 at that point. But with the price of gold going up, you know, miners are going back in and processing tailings and stuff that wasn't economically feasible. But see, what you do is say there's a mine someplace, and they've been following a vein, and all of a sudden it just disappears. But you're able to I'll let you tell folks about that because you're able to
figure
out a gradient and you know if there's been an earthquake or something. And yeah, go ahead.
I can track a vein, of course. You know, I don't care how long it is or relatively speaking how deep it is. I can track it, and I can actually measure its relative density or quantification on different parts of the vein. And, you know, for example, when I was doing some tests in the laboratory a few years ago, I had a lot of lead in there, and I had probably about 1,000 pounds of lead, starting with an ounce or two. And I noticed when I would set my machine for lead, depending on the size of the lead, how far, when you stimulate an element, my machine's attracted to it. When you get close to it, it repels. And the little antenna that I use is swivel. And so I noticed that when you got close to it, it pushed it away. But I also noticed that if it weighed 100 pounds, it'll push your swivel antenna back about 12 inches.
Mm-hmm.
If you have 50 pounds, it would push it back less than half that much.
Mm-hmm.
So I built a spreadsheet on that, and I took it all the way to 1,000 pounds. So I would know by how far back the repulsion mode pushed an antenna the actual atomic weight of what I was dealing with.
Uh-huh.
And then from there, I took it up to, you know, probably 50,000 pounds.
Uh-huh.
So now I can actually detect the target. And the beauty of it is you can put a gold coin in a lead box, and you can bury it 100 feet deep, and I can go right through the ground, right through the lead box, and tell you about the weight of that coin.
Uh-huh. You know, so
within 80% of the weight, it's not deadly accurate on that, but it's pretty much in the ballpark.
And this sounds fantastic to people that don't have any real firm footing in science, but folks, I want you to know, Robert taught me a very crude method, you know, while using a machine, just but with using a magnet and dowsing rod, how this is done. And I was telling some Apache friends of mine in Colorado, and Jimmy Ten Rivers has been a treasure hunter for years, and went to his house, and I was telling about Robert's system. And he says, "Oh, that's, you know, that's, and I," he said, I don't believe it." I said, "Okay, well, Jimmy has been a legal cannabis grower for many years." And I said, "Okay, I'll tell you what." I said, "This not only works for elements." I said, "This will work for cannabis." I said, "Why don't you give me a small bud?" And so he went in and had me a little bud. It probably weighed, you know, 5 grams, something like that, about as big as your thumbnail. And I said, "What I'm going to do is," I said, "now, the layout of the living room was, you walk in the living room, and immediately to the right, there's kind of a home entertainment center, and on the left, there's a couch, and in the back of the room, there's another couch, and some bookshelves." And I said, "What I want you to do," as I said, I'm going to place this bud, as I recall, it was on the negative pole of the rare earth magnet that I had that Robert gave me.
Yeah, the south pole.
And I'm going to turn my back where I can't see, and I'm going to put my fingers in my ears, and I'm going to go la 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 and stamp my feet, so I will not have any idea where you're going to hide another little bit of cannabis. And and I said, "I want you to tap me on the shoulder when you're done." And and that's exactly what happened. And when I turned around, the antenna swung right over toward the corner of the couch, and I walked over there, and I got close to it, and the antenna started to push back a little bit. And I said, "Is it under this corner of the couch?" He says, "I can't." He says, "Yeah." And he walked right over and pulled it out. So, true story, folks.
Hi, friends. This is Will Bluewater. If you have been listening to our program for long, then you know that Mark the Badger Borcherding does a Mayan birth reading for each of our interview guests. Mark suggested that he give away a free reading for each donation of $20 or more to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a ministry of Oklahoma Native American Church, or the White Roots of Peace. So please support Prophecy Keepers Radio by making your free will offering at nativeamericanchurch.us, and you'll receive this gift reading. If you choose to make a recurring donation, once you've received your own reading, you can give readings away as free gifts. So why not head over to nativeamericanchurch.us and make an offering right now. Hope to be talking with you soon. Bye now.
And then we went out the next day to a waterfall up in the mountains near Walsenburg that had been used for, oh, maybe 400 or 500 years. And we figured there might be something buried up there. And we immediately found with the dowsing rods using, actually we were looking for silver. We used a silver coin. And there were some large, you know, old campfires, you know, with a lot of rocks in them. I got, you know, about 2-3 feet away from the campfire, and they started repelling back, and then as I got right over the, kind of the center of the campfire, the antenna actually started spinning. Well, we weren't able to excavate. We didn't have the right tools, and there was a huge storm heading there, and it was a very remote area, so we beat feed, and I don't know whether Jimmy ever went back and excavated there, but anyway, that's just an addendum to what Robert was saying, and it doesn't just work for metals and treasure.
Yeah, the magnetron system is what I call that with magnets. It has its drawbacks, but it is functional, you know. Very interesting method. I pretty well stick to frequencies because they work better with the way I'm applying the system right now. But, yeah.
And you could also, I guess you can actually dial in a cord of, you've gone out and you can actually determine the gender of an animal. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of you, so go ahead. And you've also... You've told me.
Yeah, that's possible. That sure is possible. That's
You told me some stories that, you know, don't necessarily want to reveal here, so I don't want to get ahead of you.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing that I do quite a bit of, and I did some tests for these people, and what they did was they took a bed and they put a sheet of yellow brass on one end and a sheet of red brass on the other, and then they covered it with a quilt. So I locked on the one of them, and I said, that one is yellow brass. And then the other one, it took me about 20 minutes, and I said, this one's red brass. And I said, and I gave him the rough weight. That was about 85% accurate. And I said, how do you do that? And I said, well, first off, I said, I can quantify any element. And so yellow brass is about 15% zinc and 85% copper, and the red brass has no copper. So I quantified basically the brass and both of them and got their weight. And then I took one of them and I set it for zinc and measured how much zinc was in it and then against how much copper, and it had to be yellow brass. And it kind of reminds me, in archaeology, you know, a lot of people have probably heard about that Egyptian find in the Grand Canyon in 1908, 1909. Well, you know, I've gone to that area and I've shot signals into that area. And basically, I could identify that as Egyptian just by the content. What I did was, I know the Egyptians used galena for some of their eyeshadow and makeup. I got a read on galena, flax, cotton, bronze, brass, tin, copper, iron, henna, which they use for hair dye. And I started running some of and including papyrus paper. So once you can actually identify an archaeological site if you know, with my system. But what's interesting about it is that site in the Grand Canyon is an interesting site, but there's similar sites in northern Arizona and southern Utah. I've probably detected at least 15 of them.
From what I recall, I guess you could tell a Spanish barrel because they usually would kill the slaves, so you knew there was bone there. And where there's bone, there's what, chlorine?
Well, some of the Spanish sites, of course, there can be some brass, and there can be bronze, and there can be iron, and you know, gold and silver, but you'll find gunpowder in a lot of them. And, you know, the Egyptians didn't have gunpowder. You can pretty well identify it. If you know what the compound is supposed to be, and I can identify it with my machine, which gives me a pretty good idea.
And then, you know, you've identified, you know, hundreds of targets, but, you know, most of them... you're not allowed to dig on, BLM, without a permit, unless it's just with a shovel.
Scott, there's so many legal ramifications involved in treasure trove, and Utah has some of the worst laws on treasure trove in ancient antiquities. And, you know, you can go to prison. You're not going to get a permit that I know of. I'm saying you could never get a permit. But the treasure finder is not protected in Utah. You know, Louisiana, if you find the treasure, it's half yours by law, even if it's on private property, and it's the same way in England. Florida, if you find something off the sea, you have a certain amount of rights to, too. The state will get part of it. But, you know, there's some areas where you just can't hunt. So I don't do a lot of that in Utah. Maybe I do some for research. I know where stuff is. But there's really nothing I can do about it as far as retrieving it because of the law. You have more rights on private property. I do know people that have private property, and I've negotiated with probably 8 different people that have stuff on private property. And, you know, most people they find out there's something on their property, they don't want to deal with you, and they want to find it themselves. And they don't have a clue on how difficult that could be without the right kind of detection equipment. So I have not really been fruitful in dealing with people so far in Utah on private property either, and that's okay.
Uh-huh.
At some point, I'm going to go to states where they favor treasure hunters, and I'll be doing some looking there.
Uh-huh. Boy, I wish you could find the old Cherokee mines here in down in northwest Georgia. The Cherokees were miners. I was just talking the other night with Chief Charles Jotlohi Rogers, and he was telling me that the Cherokee served as a buffer between Santa Ana and Houston's troops, and without the Cherokee doing that, there would be no Texas Republic. And but after Houston left office, they were driven out by a successor violently. And you know, once they got down there, some of them got involved in mining, and some of them are very, very wealthy people. And it's a absolutely fascinating subject, and you've done an unbelievable amount of work. You got my attention. I know you have attention of a lot of others. Well, what makes so your detection? There's others that have systems that are similar to yours. As a matter of fact, I remember once you got back to northern Utah, you heard from a barber that there was a fellow nearby that had a similar machine, and he never really did, you know, you guys didn't swap notes, you know, other than, you know, what you could see. But what makes your, there's even a guy in Utah that's claiming, you know, he's invented the tricorder and this kind of nonsense. And what makes yours better than the others out there then?
Well, what makes mine better is this, Scott. You go to somebody's place of business, they put on a demonstration for you, and they show you that they can detect gold or silver. You get pretty excited about it, and you buy it anywhere from $1,000 to $50,000. You go out in the field, and then you start digging holes, and you can't find anything. You say, what in the hell is going on? Well, the guy that sells you the equipment, he didn't have to give you your money back.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on in the field, what I discovered, is that entrainment. So you stimulate a target, you stimulate gold, and there's iron there, and there's all kinds of other elements. And what happens is your signal starts traveling, and it starts entraining all those other elements, and you'll get various reads everywhere. They cannot sort the false reads from the real reads.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes those are called ghost reads. So if the target's in a certain spot, the ions will travel horizontally in the ground and pop up in different places. So if you had, let's say you had a target in some blow sand, but to one side was some clay, well, clay's got metal in it. And your signals will travel and your ions will travel sideways and they'll come right up on that. And you'll get reads. So when they get out in the field, they can't find anything. They say, what now? And another thing that, you know, say these guys don't do that I've done, and I have never, ever seen anybody do this except myself. I would call somebody up, a good friend, and I'd say, hey, look, I need you to take 50 pounds of lead, and I need you to bury it out in the country, and don't tell me where it's at, and then I'm going to go find it. I have done so many blind tests like that that I can't even count them. And you know what? I have never missed a target.
Uh-huh.
I have done many, many, many blind tests. I've had people bury copper, tin, lead, and you name it. And not only can I find it, but I can, if I tell them, don't tell me how much weight it is, I can tell them about how much weight it is.
Uh-huh.
You know, I did a blind test for a guy in Florida one time, and he's an archaeologist. He says, Robert, I'd like you to help me, but he says, your methods are unknown and they're unorthodox. And he says, I'd like you to do a blind test. And I said, well, Mark, I'll be glad to do a blind test for you. He says, well, I want you to find this ship in these waters. And he says, I'm going to give you 20 miles by 20 miles. And I said, oh, my God, that's 400 square miles. He said, you know darn well in those waters, you can't count the number of ships that are there.
I was hoping you were going to tell this story.
He says, God, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Spanish galleons that have gone down. And he says, well, I says, I need to know some of the content so I can cross-reference it. He says, it went down in 1845, I believe. And he says it was carrying a lot of porcelain. It was carrying cases of wine and gold. He says, I have the manifest of the ship. He says, I know where it's at. It's in Canadian waters. They won't give me a permit. He says, so I can't salvage it. I said, well, I can't guarantee you that I can find it because I'm going to lock off to a lot of other vessels there. But considering that there's quite a bit of porcelain and there is wine and some gold, I might be able to find it. So I set to work and I detected it. I quantified the porcelain to be 4,500 pounds. I didn't quantify the wine, but I did detect it. And I quantified the gold to be 900 pounds. And once I told Mark what I found, he says, yeah, and gave him the GPS. He says, you know, Robert, he says, you know that ship. And he says, the manifest shows 875 pounds. He says, so you're only 25 pounds off.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know.
And you did this from a distance of what?
Well, Scott,
you didn't go there, right?
I'm going to tell you something that not very many people know. You know, David Nueva, the guy's name, that showed that elements put out ion particles that can be detected with a very dark filter on a camera. Well, the truth is, when you photograph anything, all those ions are present, and you and I cannot see them visibly because they're in terahertz. Beyond, we cannot see that. But it is picked up by a camera. It is recorded in the picture. So if there's gold buried someplace, those gold ions are recorded in that picture, whether you can see them with your eyes or not. When I set my machine for gold, it stimulates those ions, and I'll actually get a little bit of energy will come out of that photograph, and I can actually isolate on that photograph where that's coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I did it. I did that in right here in my house in Manti, Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in Florida. I did it on a Google image. And Mark says, I have never seen, he says, I ever tell anybody about this. He says, they're going to laugh me all the way to China. He says, so I could never get money promoted on the possibility that somebody doused it. And I don't call it dousing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. Because I'm using some technology
that's related
in that area, but I don't call it housing. And I said, you know, Mark, you're right. And so later, I detected something in Florida, right around the Brunswick area, that was probably 700 or 800 pounds ago. And you know, to this day, he's never been able to get anybody to fund it because they're afraid of it. Even though he went in there with sonar and side scan and found the debris field where a Spanish ship had gone down. They're afraid of it because they don't understand the technology, and it has the stigma of dowsing. And that's just, it's okay. That's your choice.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all right.
Well, who knows, 700 years from now, you may be, you know, when the Star Trek type stuff, you know, is used by everybody, you know, who knows? You know, you may be the most famous guy in the world that you just don't know.
Well, you know, John Dee corrected the Gregorian calendar, and so many scholars were rivalous and jealous of him that he wasn't recognized until 100 years after he died.
Yeah.
and that happens. But, you know,
Tesla is another example. And they're, you take your iPad and put it on a... Just put it on a pad, you know, and that recharges it. Well, you know, that's Tesla. And of course, back then you had this big fight between, Westinghouse and these other guys, and there was the guy that invented the light bulb that we use. You know, he sent out a warning in 1887 about alternating current, and people don't really understand, you know, the history of most everything. Whether it's electricity or whatever, it's.
Well, Scott, you know, the average invention that's been invented and developed where it works, only 17% of the parameters on the average is known about the technology and how that works.
Hmm.
So when I explored resonation technology, I realized that, And I realized there was a lot of things that people didn't know. And I studied it like a cloistered monk. Now I know. I know what causes it. But, I did a blind test last week. And the reason I did it wasn't to show that I could do anything. It's because I needed to practice in an area that was so difficult that it would be almost impossible to detect anything in that area. And the area was a junkyard where you had multiple metals buried on the ground and on the surface of the ground in every place, including several hundred lead batteries. And I asked the guy, I said, I need to do this blind test because that's the most difficult turf that can be found for detecting something like silver. Because for one, all lead has a little bit of silver in it. So what's going to happen is it's going to tend to entrain the lead. And so I said, I told him, I said, I need you to bury some silver there. And then don't tell me where it's at, and I want to find it. But I told him it might take me a week to find it. It's going to be work. And he agreed to that, and he told me, he says, well, Robert, he says, I want you to know that I don't have to bury any silver because I buried silver there 35 years ago. You find it. And I found it. And now this guy, he's a private guy. He's a farmer. And he's one of those people that know what I can do. He's not a scientist. But he knows one thing. I didn't only find the silver on his property, but I found the silver on his son's property 2 blocks down the road from there.
Uh-huh. Friends, this is Will Blue Otter, encouraging you to obtain an authorized participant or AP card and become a federally recognized Native religious practitioner. Presently, Aqua Native American Church is the only Native American church spiritually blessed by the Rosebud Reservation Native American Church and has a certificate of existence in the state of Utah that is authorized to worship on or off tribal grounds and has met the standard of sincerity and vow of poverty standards in the state of Utah and federal courts. This card is designed to assist all people regardless of their racial makeup, political affiliation, social and/or financial status, and receiving their constitutional rights. This card is also designed to assist United States judicial officials to honor their solemn oath to protect and exercise the principles of the United States Constitution while carrying out their duty and serving their fellow citizens. To join the movement that is strengthening and exercising the principles of the United States Constitution, please obtain your AP card by visiting NativeAmericanChurch.us today.
So, in exactly. Very difficult places to look. So,
well, I know I was reading that the National Park Service, to discourage artifact hunters, sprays the ground. I can't remember what they spray the ground with, but it's something that apparently is reflective and doesn't allow to really look for, because there's probably a million mini balls laying around there. Everybody wants one, and so with the metal detector, I mean, you're really fighting nature, and you have to kind of to figure out what your workarounds are. And it took you a long time to perfect this. When did you start all this?
Well, Scott, I bought my first metal detector probably 30 years ago, and then close to 20 years ago, I bought a pretty good machine for almost $10,000. It was called the Pulse CM83, and it's a pretty good machine, but the problem with the machine is when you have heavy solar flares, it doesn't work that good.
Mm.
As far as resonation technology, I started dealing with it probably about 15 years ago, and then about 8 years ago, I got real serious and started my research, and it's taken me between 7 and 8 years to take it to the state of the art that I have it at present.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't easy. You have no idea on how many problems in the field. See, you can detect a gold coin and a piece of silver in an office, but you get out there in the mountains, you know, the conditions are very different. You know, you have endo and exothermal effects, which is temperature, which also changes the atomic spacing of the elements. You have cosmic anomalies that also change it. Oh, and you've got so many things that will entrain your target. It's a totally different thing to be out in the field than it is in an office detecting a piece of metal. And so it took me 8 years to figure it out.
Well, I worked in the scouting profession for, in the youth profession for many years until my son was born, and at that time I had to figure out something else to do. And by chance, I got involved with natural gas leak survey, I worked for Southern Cross Corporation. I worked for Heath Consultants, and you know, you were telling me about the ions a minute ago. It almost sounds like, gas. The way we used to survey gas down here in the South, they do a vegetation survey, and they'll walk up in front of a house and they'll look at it. They'll be able to see the meter, and then they'll just with their eye trace out to the meter, you know, approximately where the service line will hit the curb. And if the if there's an unusual flare of and a lot of growth of brilliant green grass, or if there's a sterile spot there, they know they've got a gas leak there. But so the gas travels underneath the pavement. Well, I know the biggest leak I ever found, I found it on Jerry Falwell's church in Lynchburg, Virginia. I found it on the meter, but it was coming from a half a block away from where it came off of the main. And so is it apples and oranges here, or is it a similar situation where you know, the ions will travel away underneath something? Or...
They can, Scott, because they're affected by the magnetic lines on the earth. And they're also affected by other elements. And another thing, too, about metal, whenever you got metal under the ground, metal pulls krypton gas to it. And so anytime you find a metal target, if you set your machine for krypton gas, you'll detect it there. So that's another way of actually, but again, that stuff will travel. You know, like the ions coming from a target. I was in an area one time in the canyon, and I knew the Spanish had been in there, and they had mined it. And you know, you go in there and you see their symbols everywhere. And so this was early on, so I detected a target, and I went there, and I thought, my God! So I dug, and I didn't find anything. So I took soil samples, took it back to the lab. Assayed it, and there was over 400 ounces of gold per ton in that soil. I realized the Spanish were mining there. So later I went in there and I detected 6 or 8 spots which were all that rich. And then at one point I finally detected where the treasure was actually buried. I can't dig that treasure lawfully, and I won't. But what the interesting was is when I stimulated it, it's kind of like walking past high voltage. If you've got metal in your pocket, it's going to jump out and grab that metal.
Okay? Uh-huh.
So when you stimulate a target, it'll send the ions out, and it'll grab all those other spots where there's little pieces of metal or gold ore. And it did. It was kind of like an octopus. It reached out and it grabbed so many spots until I learned how to knock that out and only pick up solid metal. That was one of the most difficult places that I've ever spent any time detecting. So, yeah, it does travel. The ions will travel. And they can come out of the ground at a 22-degree angle, a 35-degree angle, a 40-degree angle, and they can go up and come out in the wrong place. And, you know, you can dig there until doomsday, but you're not going to find the target until you know how. So that was one thing that I overcame in the field.
So your percentage of accuracy is about 85%, you figure?
About 85% accurate. And I'm only saying that because on my quantification, I'm at least 85% accurate on the weight. As far as exactly where it's located, you know, on those two targets that I did last week on a blind test, you know, I could, and because of the turf and because of the terrain and because there were so many other elements buried in the ground, I could only tell within 10 feet of where those targets were at. When you consider 1,500 feet by 1,500 feet and you can get it that close, that's not bad, because the rest of the work you can either do with a ground-penetrating radar or a really good metal detector or an EM83 or something like that, and I have, you know, some of that equipment. So that's viable, for sure. So I'm saying 85% accurate because some targets are very, very difficult to pinpoint.
Well, if you wanted to bury a metal object, and you didn't want someone who had access to a lot of money and high technology, and you didn't want to bury it very deep, how would you do it?
Well, if I wanted to bury it where it couldn't be detected by other people, I'd bury it in a garbage dump. Either that or a clay deposit.
Mm-hmm.
Those are tough to detect. And, you know, and two, if you're going to, you know, I was telling a guy one time, he says, well, how would I bury this stuff and not have it be found? I says, well, you know, you go out in the country and you dig a hole and you bury something, you cover it up, you've reached the ground, and that can be picked up by the satellites.
Mm-hmm.
And it can, infrared, that's easy. I have
FLIR, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, what you do if you want to bury something, you go out and you camp in a tent in an area where there's a lot of bentonite. And then you just dig a hole in the bottom of your tent. And then you bury it there in the bentonite, and then you cover it with a sheet of asbestos, because satellites cannot go through asbestos.
Mm-hmm.
I said, then you move your tent, once it's buried and you've tamped your soil good, you move your tent back, okay? And then you put a ring of rocks around it and put a bunch of wood on it and build a fire. Then when the satellite goes by, another campfire. Even if they do penetrate it, they're not going to see through the asbestos.
Mm-hmm.
And you're already in an area full of bentonite, so what are they going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Right.
My specialty is detection, so I have to know those things.
Right. Well, now, we had a mutual friend, Robert Three Eagles. I don't know if you want to go into, you know, and you've also had a friend that used the same technology to just, it wasn't interesting treasure hunting, but he's found dinosaur bones. Do you want to get into either of those subjects?
Oh, Stephen Jepson?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just the uses other than for treasure. I mean, just for cultural uses.
Well, Stephen, he was pretty good at what he did. I spent at least 2 years working with him in the field, and he did find a lot of woolly mammoths and
mm-hmm.
some dinosaurs, and I think one of, I'm not sure, it could have been a Camus Rex or something like that. He found through a guy at the University of Utah.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen was awfully good at finding stuff, and like I said, I spent some time with him in the field. Stephen got cancer and died, unfortunately, so he's not with us anymore.
Mm-hmm. Do you care to tell the story about him calling you from Walmart?
Oh, yeah, I told Stephen one day, I said, well, he and I were really good friends, and sometimes we would joke with one another, and sometimes we'd kind of kid each other about that. And I said, well, Stephen, I says, I can do something you can't do. And he says, what's that, Robert? And I says, I can tell whether in a graveyard, I can tell whether it's male or female. Without, you know, digging the grave up, just by detecting it. And he said, no, you can't. And I said, Stephen, I can't do. And he says, no, you can't. Nobody can. I said, yeah, you can. I said, you got a pencil? And he said, yeah. And I said, write down these numbers. So I wrote down two numbers. One was the atomic spacing and frequency of testosterone, and the other was estrogen. He said, I don't believe it. I said, yeah, try it. So he goes over to Walmart, and he sits in his vehicle. He sets his frequencies for
Testosterone. Right.
Mm-hmm. And he started walking on the men, especially young men. And the old men, it wasn't the strongest signal. And then a truck driver pulled up, and he couldn't understand why he didn't read on that truck driver, and he got out, and it was a woman truck driver.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he called me up, and he says, Robert, he says, I see what you're talking about. And
mm-hmm.
Right.
And from what I recall, I guess a few days later, he had left those settings on there, and he, you know, turned on his machine and his. And do you want to tell that story about what he noticed, that it works on living? Well, he knew it worked on living. I guess.
Oh, he went to the graveyard like I did, and
mm-hmm.
you know, stood back a few hundred yards and slowly walked towards it, and he noticed that all the graveyards, all the headstones, where the reeds were the strongest, where it would get the date of birth and the date of death, were young men, 18, 20, 30 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ones that were older people, the reeds weren't nearly as strong. They don't have as much testosterone. But
mm-hmm.
it doesn't matter how long the body's been dead, to my knowledge, you know, the testosterone will still read. So it's kind of an interesting guess.
Right. So this really is Star Trek technology, and in its infancy, and you know, in the future, you know, if a starship pulls up on a planet, well, you know, if this can be done from satellites, and we've got a pretty good inkling that the government's perfected this and they know all about it since the 60s and probably have used it in, you know, in the submarines and
If this was put, this could be put to that, and then you could scan a town or a house,
yeah,
and you'd get a complete readout of every element and its quantification percentage,
yeah,
and every chemical. You know, I did some tests on that too. You know, I had some medical drugs here, like naproxen and et cetera. I can get their frequencies. I have them, and I can detect. You know, one guy says, well, he says, I've never used marijuana. And I just laughed. I said, well, let me see. So I set my machine on, and I said, you got it in your blood. I would never do that, you know, for a living.
Right, right.
You know.
Well, you know, about a year ago, you could do it for a living. I mean, you could save a lot of lives, with these... these improvised explosive, the IEDs that everybody's talking about, you know, most of them are made with palm oil, 5-gallon containers.
Oh, I could detect it, of course.
Yeah, you could teach the Army how to detect it just by, looking for the container.
Well, Scott, I could do that, and they would know how, and it would work every time, and I could guarantee it, but here's the problem there. Two different people sold machines to the government. One guy made $80 million.
I remember that a couple of years ago.
It did not work, and the government spent all that money, and people were getting hurt, and finally some officers decided to test it, and they smuggled through some bombs, and it was never detected.
Yeah.
And right now they're so angry and so upset over the problem, it was a fraudulent deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could do some in a blind test. And I could chill it if I wanted to do that. I don't have the occasion to do that at present.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it works, but there's a lot of prejudice and concern during that right now because of that incident with the military.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they were looking for ways to save lives, and it's unfortunate.
Sure.
So sometimes it takes 100 years for people to come around and to get rid of their prejudices and. Let's see. What were some of the other things you were telling me that were so fascinating? I'm kind of vamping right here. I'm trying to remember. Of course, there's this. Well, I don't know if you want to get into that story about the little one-inch metal ball that you have, and we could go off into UFOs and a lot of the things if we wanted to.
I'll talk about that.
Okay.
Now. Okay, I grew up in southern Utah, in Kanab, and that's not very far from where all that Egyptian stuff was found in 1909 and 1908. So we were pretty close. So when I was a young child in the 50s, my older brothers did a lot of digging. In those days, it may have been illegal, but nobody really policed it. And me and other people in Kanab would do the same thing, and we would dig up artifacts and we'd sell them to the tourists, and we didn't think much about it. Well, you know, one time my older brothers dug up two skeletons, and they were so tall, I would say about 12 feet tall. And also my friend, the Judds, they dug up some stuff up Johnson Canyon, which was about 8 miles east of Kanab. And in that burial, the guy in front was actually a Negro, and he was 9 feet tall. And the other people that were buried there were white people, and they were not giants. And the guy had a little container on his body, okay? In that container was a metal ball. We had also found some of those metal balls, and they were so hard, you could not drill them with a drill bit or cut them with a hacksaw. Not the ones we had in the 50s, at least, okay? And I always wondered what those metal balls were. Now, that site that the Judds found, I also took a parchment with Dr. Ghostwolf,
mm-hmm.
and we had a forensic done on that parchment. It's very ancient, and it's probably Egyptian. And that came out of that burial, too. But finally, just last year, I got that metal ball from the Judds, and I did a spectrograph on it. And that metal ball has got uranium in it, plutonium-138, 139, thorium, and 5 platinum group metals in gold and silver. It's a very complex. And I personally believe it's some kind of a nuclear battery.
Prophecy Keeper, Prophecy Keeper.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all past Prophecy Keepers interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keepers does need money to continue to operate. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
Now, the container that it was in was kind of a reddish-brown material, and I had a spectrograph done on that. And it's mostly boron. Now, let's just think about this for a minute. Why did they use boron in a nuclear reactor? It's because it slows down the neutrons. So that would shield in the nuclear inside that little metal ball.
And, of course, UFO people, abduction people, a lot of them have been implanted, with certain things. And, is it possible that these metal balls, if these Nephilim or whatever you want to call them are from off of this world, and, if they were promised, someday, we'll repatriate your remains to the home world, could it have been a way for, for them to be retrieved? To be found and eventually retrieved.
Oh, it would certainly have a signal, and it certainly have a signature, and I want to tell you how it goes, how that signature goes. Let's take an alloy of copper and zinc and lead, and let's just make a ball on that. And now I'll put in the frequency of copper, and I'll put in the frequency of zinc, and I'll put in the frequency of lead. And then I'll do a compound frequency, so it'll catch all three. Okay. And so you set the ball out there, and I turn my little machine on. It'll stimulate it, and the ions will resonate and vibrate. And after that happens, it produces a magnetic field around the target, and then I detect the magnetic field. So I got three elements, and I've got the compound frequency for three elements. That's all. Now, if I was to put a fourth element in there, that compound frequency that was not there, I wouldn't get any reading whatsoever on that target. None. Now, so I took that metal ball, and it's got five platinum group metals in it, and several in it, and silver, uranium, plutonium, thorium, and I did a compound frequency, and I was actually running three Fangway generators at the same time, and so I had stages of compound frequencies, and I picked that metal ball up just perfect. Uh-huh. But then I added one element there that was not there, and I lost my signal. I'm saying this for a reason. So I know the signature of that metal ball. So I traveled and went to a lot of areas in Utah, and the metal balls were everywhere.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I can quantify how much weight's there, too. So I thought, I'm going to try something very unusual because that's the way I am. So I thought, I was reading about the Bigelow Ranch, Skinwalker Ranch, over by Roosevelt, Utah.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of mystery around that, a lot of strange phenomena that goes on there.
Uh-huh.
You know, probably a scientific reason. You know, there could be something buried there that people know. So I said it for a different woman. Finally, I said it for plutonium. And not only did I get a read, it's about 800 feet deep. It is so big, there's so much plutonium in it. The kind of plutonium, not the kind you use for a bomb, but the kind you use for electricity. It is so vast that it would make 50 power plants as big as the one in New Mexico.
Did you know that Bigelow, and I was watching Conspiracy Files with Jesse Ventura, David Bigelow, if you were to call the government and want to make a UFO report, they would give you David Bigelow's 800 number. He's now in charge of it. That's if you go back, I'll see if I can find it on YouTube, but it was the last episode. And, yeah, he's in charge now. And he actually has his own orbiting platforms now. He's the man.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, underground there is an enormous amount of plutonium, and it's a power plant. And I think, in my own opinion, okay, the stuff people seen there were three-dimensional mirages. It was created with their technology because they want to spook people and they want to keep them away from that spot, and I think that's all it is. That's my opinion.
Interesting. Huh. Yeah, the origins of which, you know, who knows where it comes from. And, I think, you know, you can't grow to be more than, you know, 20 years old without noticing that you know, our government, you know, that claims to be so altruistic, you know, there's a lot of places in the world that we can intervene and help people, but it seems like, you know, we only go help those areas where there's something to make us richer. Hawaii.
It's pretty much commercial.
Yeah, the Hawaiian Islands is a perfect example. If you go in and look at what happened in Hawaii, basically the white business interests just decided that they were going to take over, and they borrowed some ideas from the American Revolution, and then they invited you know, Marines to come, you know. And, you know, and Bill Clinton apologized but, you know, it was a done deal. And but I guess last year it was announced that I guess the some of the largest deposits of lithium in the world have been discovered in Afghanistan. And I was saying to myself, oh, that's why we're there, because, shoot, you know, the United States government has probably known about that for a long time. They probably...
Oh, they have. There's also a large deposit in South America that I detected that I doubt if anybody knows, but I don't know, really.
Well, the oil companies, this is how oil companies find oil. And they show you on their commercials how they find stuff underground. I mean, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist anymore to figure out what's going on. And, you know, now they're drawing down in Afghanistan, and, you know, they're going to be enforcing the peace, and now, you know, we're going to go after the mining interests will go in there, and everybody.
Hey, Scott, it all relates to money, enterprise, commerce, and business.
That's right.
That's where it's all at. Even most of our laws in this country are tied into enterprise and business and commerce. And
yeah.
That kind of circumvents the Constitution in the United States, really, in a way it does.
Uh-huh.
You're tied into agreements and contracts and the commercial. And you could lose your rights.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Well, yeah, a lot of people are looking at the gun issue right now. And I was reading You know, I've been a gun advocate for a long time, and you have too, but I was reading an article called The Secret History of Guns, and I had known in my research that back in the colonial days, you know, if you didn't have, that you were required to have a gun in most of the colonies. If you didn't have one, they'd give you one. But everybody was in the militia, and if they gave you a gun, they knew you had it, and it was subject to being inspected to make sure that you didn't let it rust.
Yeah.
And I guess looking at the Black Panther movement and what they realized back in the 60s was that, you know, the NRA probably wouldn't support the Founding Fathers for re-election now, because it just seems like guns were a convenience, you know, as long as our leaders wanted us to have guns, you know, we were going to have guns. And then they, you know, as civilization became more civil, then they, you know, they fell out of style. You know, I mean, let's face it, it's hard to carry a gun. You know, they're heavy, they're cumbersome, and
yeah.
Now that they're out of style, now that we've got all these problems, and now they want to take them away, and people are really beginning to look at these things under a microscope, and about, you know, really, you know, how governments work and how controlled we are,
I know they want to take our guns, and I don't agree with that. I think that the citizens ought to be armed as long as they're not felons, you know.
Yeah.
As long as they have, you know, a clean police record. You know, I mean, I don't know about you, but I saved my own life once because I had a gun, and another time I saved a woman from being raped by being gang raped because I had a gun.
Oh yeah.
Well, I didn't hurt anybody with that gun. All I did was help somebody, and you know, I've helped.
Mm-hmm.
There's been times I've had to help policemen. Well, why should they take my guns away? It's going to hurt this, you know, I'm the kind of guy. You know, I got stopped by a policeman in Colorado all the time. And my tell light was at a bad tell light, and we talked to him. I had my lie of showing my gun permit. He looked at me and he said, you know, Robert, he said, I'm so, it always makes me feel good when I find an armed citizen that's legally armed.
Uh-huh.
And he said, I feel a lot safer because I know that if I need help, there's somebody to support me.
Uh-huh.
Well, not the policeman.
If you got a concealed, yeah, if you got a concealed permit in Texas, you can walk past the metal detectors into the state house with your weapon. I mean, that's,
you know what? That's the way it should be, Scott.
Yeah.
You know, they ought to take people that are veterans of wars that have a clean police record, and they ought to just give them a full-time carry permit any place in the United States, including a plane. Because if one of those guys was on an airplane and there was trouble, he's going to defend us.
Well, in 1946, you know, there was trouble in Athens, Tennessee, here in McMinnville. You know, the vets got home and they realized that, political cronyism had taken over. Matter of fact, you can go to YouTube and just put in Battle of Athens. They made a movie about this back in the 80s.
I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I just looked at it again recently.
Right. The guy that played Admiral Chegwin and Jag, you know, played the corrupt sheriff. And, you know, at the time, there was a great outcry, but FDR's wife came out and said, hey, you know, they did what was right. And actually, these guys who are, if you're a combat veteran and you're just honorary discharge, you're something called reserve militia. And but, you know, we're just getting so far from our roots. And, you know, with the looming financial collapse, you know, what you're doing is very important, because you know, they're even making sci-fi movies about, you know, what would happen. I mean, there's one that just started up the other night. You know, what would happen if our government collapsed and just became passé, basically it was a story about how the corporations took over and formed a Congress, and you know, no longer had no right to keep and bear arms, no right to assembly, but everybody was just getting so rich, and you know, basically they're just well-fed, well-kept slaves, and kind of unfortunate, and it seems like that's the way we're headed. And
it's not good. It's not good at all, Scott. I don't know what the final outcome's going to be.
Yeah.
God help us.
Yeah, I don't look forward to, you know, for our children and grandchildren, and I'm trying to think of some of the other. There's been so much that's passed between you and I about this technology that it's kind of hard to remember it all. But is there anything else you did we cover it all? Is there anything else you wanted to add about this?
There's just one thing that I want to put kind of highlight and put more emphasis on than all the rest of it, because, you know, I could talk about the technology all day and all night, and I've got some of them on my website, but the most important aspect of it is this, and I'll highlight this, and that is this. I have done 24 blind tests in the last 3 months, and I have passed every one of them, and I am the only person that I know of that has done that successfully. Mm-hmm. Nobody else wants to be blind tested. They don't want to be tested with what they do. They're afraid of it. And that's what I wanted to highlight. I know I got to get outside here pretty soon, too, Scott, and do some work. It's about 0 degrees.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, tell folks about your letter from the ICP. What do you have, letters from one or two of the best assay, even though you're not, you know, doing assay work right now, tell them about that, and letters of recommendation from state geologists and so forth.
I'm not doing any fire assay work right now. One thing I can do that I do once in a while, and that I don't, is I do my own, I call it electronic assay, because I can take some ore, and I can send frequencies in there and tell you if there's any gold or platinum or silver in there, but I cannot quantify something that's a small amount. In other words, if I'm to quantify something, I'd have to, with this system, because I use a choke on my system, because I don't want to pick up any small stuff. So I want to know I'm picking up some pretty solid. But a 5 gallon bucket of ore, I can usually tell about how much gold is in it. It's just my electronic system. And so anyway, I've done a little bit of that work. But as far as fire assays, I'm not doing that right now. For one, there's too many chemicals, and I'm 63 years old.
Uh-huh.
I've breathed too many chemicals, and I really want to get away from that because my lungs aren't that good of shape.
Yeah, anyway. I remember the night somebody dropped off those two buckets, and I slept in there with a pistol, the sugar ore, and there's a risk in this business, and you didn't have a lot of money to run your lab off. It took you 10 years to put it together, and you didn't have money for proper fume hoods, but if you had.
Well,
you know, you would have, as it was, you know, you took enough gold out of those two buckets to buy yourself a truck. But,
well, you know, my original intent, Scott, wasn't to make a lot of money. It was to do research.
Right.
And so I ended up making enough money to barely keep the thing alive, and I did a lot of research, and I've completed with most of the research. It would be nice to have another lab, but it served its purpose for the time being.
Right. Yeah, I always said if I ever won the lottery, the first thing I'd do is, you know, build you a proper lab and a pilot plant, and we'd go for it. It would take several million dollars, you know, and who's got that kind of money? And particularly if you're not familiar with the science and don't understand what's going on, but you know, if an angel investor ever did come along, what do you think you might do? I guess you just have to pray about it, huh?
Well, I'd have to pray about it, Scott, but I do love science and research, and I'd probably spend a lot of time doing that. And I also want to get a little place where I can do some permaculture.
Right.
And that'd be a lot of fun, and my wife would like to do that, too. So at some point, if we, you know, I'm hoping this coming year there's some mining claims I want to file. That's really good, and once we do that, you know, it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to, you know, we've got to go through all the little hoops, get permits and so on, and bond it and all that. Once that's done, and when we're fruitful, and I don't know if we will be next year, but we're going to file as soon as the snow clears. And so we could make a lot of money on that project, and when we do, then I'll be working on this other stuff that I like to do.
Fantastic.
Hi friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you have been listening to our program for long, then you know that Mark the Badger Borcherding does a Mayan birth reading for each of our interview guests. Mark suggested that he give away a free reading for each donation of $20 or more to Prophecy Keepers Radio. a ministry of Oklahoma Native American Church, or the White Roots of Peace. So please support Prophecy Keepers Radio by making your free will offering at nativeamericanchurch.us, and you'll receive this gift reading. If you choose to make a recurring donation, once you've received your own reading, you can give readings away as free gifts. So why not head over to nativeamericanchurch.us and make an offering right now. Hope to be talking with you soon. Bye now.
Well, folks can reach you. How do they reach you?
435-287-8399 is my phone number, and they can reach me on the www.terrafirmaassayers.com, and that's a good way. It's got my email there, and they can, you know, reach me through that.
Really good, and it's been fun. It's been fun. We've been talking about doing this for a long time, and would have done a few months ago, but my wife got pretty ill, and you know, as you get older, you know, the problems multiply. But you know, you know, youth is wasted on the young. And
well,
I've never met anybody younger at heart than you are, and I, you know, feel that way about myself. But you know, what can you do?
Well, it's been good awfully good talking with you too, Scott. And my best regards to Linda and everything there.
Yeah, everybody. Robert knows me by my middle name, Scott, which I used to, you know, used to go by. At one point, I wanted to, my both of my grandfathers were named William, and it was just too much. I'm William Scott Anderson, but he knows me by my middle name. But I wanted to make some changes in my personality, you know, oddly enough, you know, you can make some changes, but, you know, by changing your name or even changing the way you ride.
Will, I need to start working on remembering that Will is your first name, because I knew you for a lot of years by your middle name.
Okay.
Well, I'll work on it.
Well, you know, your wife gave me my first native name, and Talking Wind. And what's interesting is it was very apropos, because my Mayan day sign is 9-eek, which is a wind sign, and a lot of people make fun of me because I've had several names, but you know, so did Crazy Horse. I guess he was known as Worm at one time. You know, you know, different nations, you know, give you different names, and you know, names are a construct in the. You know, this Roman naming system that we have basically is it's just a good way to identify you, and you know,
for sure.
And
for sure.
Well, anyway, good talking to you, Robert. And
all right, well, you be well, Amigo.
I'll be in touch about when this is going to go up online.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Carolina home, had dreams about the West and started to roam. 6 long months on a dust-covered trail. They say heaven's at the end, but so far it's been hell. And there's fire on the mountain, lightning in the air, rolling them hills, and it's waiting for me. We're digging and sifting from 5 to 5, building everything we found just to stay alive. Gold flowed free like the whiskey in the bar. Sin was the big thing, Lord, and sin was the star. And there's fire on the mountain, lightning in the air, rolling them hills, and it's waiting for me. tall girls were the evening treat. Empty cartons and bloodlines, the gooders of the street. Men were shot down for the sake of fun, or just to hear the noise of their 44 guns and their fire on the mountain, lightning in the air, rolling them hills and it's waiting for me there. Now my widow, she weeps by my grave, tears flow free for her man. Couldn't stay, shot down in cold blood by a gun that carried fame, all for a useless and no good, worthless flame. And there's fire on the mountain, lightning in the air, rolling them hills and it's waiting for me there. Fire on the mountain, lightning in the air, rolling them hills and it's waiting for me.
Friends, this is Will Blue Otter, encouraging you to obtain an authorized participant or AP card and become a federally recognized Native religious practitioner. Presently, Aqua Native American Church is the only Native American church spiritually blessed by the Rosebud Reservation Native American Church and has a certificate of existence in the state of Utah that is authorized to worship on or off tribal grounds and has met the standard of sincerity and vow of poverty standards in the state of Utah and federal courts. This card is designed to assist all people regardless of their racial makeup, political affiliation, social and/or financial status, and receiving their constitutional rights. This card is also designed to assist United States judicial officials to honor their solemn oath to protect and exercise the principles of the United States Constitution while carrying out their duty and serving their fellow citizens. To join the movement that is strengthening and exercising the principles of the United States Constitution, please obtain your AP card by visiting NativeAmericanChurch.us today.
Let the truth be known.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius.
of other times, let the wind blow. Let the truth be known to all mankind again. Prophecy keeper, prophecy keeper.
Thank you.